We move to the second case of the morning. FreeEats.com, Inc. v. the State of Indiana. Mr. Cooney.
Thank you, Your Honor. This appeal involves the constitutionality under the First Amendment and the preemption doctrine of an Indiana statute that makes it illegal for FreeEats to make pre-recorded interstate political calls to Indiana residents utilizing its interactive voice response speech recognition technology without first having a live operator come on the line and receiving the recipient's consent to play the pre-recorded portion of the call. Now, the Indiana statute violates the First Amendment insofar as it applies to political calls made using this interactive voice response technology. That is because calls made with this technology can themselves be programmed to ask the recipient, upon first picking up the phone, whether the recipient wishes to hear the pre-recorded portion of the call. And if the recipient does not grant consent, then the phone call can automatically terminate. There is no difference from this kind of pre-recorded calls soliciting consent from the degree of intrusion on residential privacy that would occur if a live operator came on the line. The same script could be given to the operator or to the pre-recorded call. While there's no difference in the degree of intrusion into privacy, there are enormous suppression of speech implications of the requirement that the state imposes, of the live operator requirement. The suppression is a factor of two forces working together. The first is the enormous cost increase imposed by a live operator requirement, which the record shows is roughly on the order of magnitude of 15 times or 1,500%.
That seems to be the main problem, is that it costs a lot more, because otherwise you have the same access only with a live operator.
Your Honor, we submit that there are actually two implications, and cost is certainly one of them, and that the cost makes it infeasible to hire large numbers of persons to introduce these calls, and the cost makes it infeasible to rely on this emerging technology. But the second implication is the delay factor, for want of a better term. The delay is simply that using electronic technology, it's possible to make these calls to, for example, in Indiana, all the residences in the state in 7 hours, whereas even having an enormous phone bank of 200 live operators making calls, it would require 35 days to make the same number of calls. And this can be critical in the period of time just before an election occurs, when you need to respond to last-minute attacks by the other side, or when you need to call the voters that you've pre-identified as likely to support your candidate, and you want to call them all in the last period just before the election and urge them to turn out.
That's important. I understand in campaigns, it takes a long time to go door to door, too, although that may be one of the most effective things for a candidate. Obviously, you can't do that statewide. But the main focus on this is on the privacy of the home and the right to be able to go into that home through this mechanism, as opposed to not being able to because of that invasion. And I think is that a right? Does the First Amendment right to do that override whatever privacy one would have in the home?
We agree, Your Honor, that's the essence of the case, and we don't doubt that protection of residential privacy is an important state interest for the state to protect. What we'd like to focus on, though, is that there is no difference in our view, between the degree of intrusion that's affected by a phone ringing, the person answering it, having a live operator saying, oh, would you be willing to listen to a call from the Citizens to Improve Care at Walter Reed Army Hospital or not? Do you give your consent? The same message can be given by a pre-recorded device as the first question. The state could draft a statute that would say, this is the People for Improvement of Care at Walter Reed. Would you give us your consent to listen to a pre-recorded message on that topic? Yes or no?
See, I think there's a huge difference when you pick up a phone and there's an automated voice talking to you than a real person. And I think you're just, I mean, it seems to me that you're just saying that, oh, there's no difference at all.
I don't know.
Personally, I get annoyed when I get these pre-recorded calls.
Well, Your Honor, I think one of the comments that's often made is that it's difficult for people to tell the difference between a pre-recorded voice and a live operator voice.
Until you try to say something, and then keep talking.
And there you come, I think, Your Honor, to another crux of the case. We're dealing with a statute that was passed in 1988. In 1988, portable phones were the size of a shoebox and BlackBerries were something that you put on your cereal. Today, that's very different. The speech technology is very different. Yes, even assuming that there could have been a constitutional basis for the statute in 1988, when all you could get was a dumb cassette, which would hook up to your phone and would play the message from beginning to end, and there was no way you could stop it. We're dealing with something very different. We're dealing with technology that can be programmed, and the first thing you would hear is a short question, identifying the speaker and saying, would you consent to hear a pre-recorded message? I think that that's different. There's no difference in the degree of intrusion between asking a focused, specific question immediately at the front of the script from the same words spoken by a live operator with that annoying click, and then the phone is dead for a second or so, and then a voice comes on and says, would you like to receive a pre-recorded message from a group? To our view, there is no difference in the degree of intrusion. Yes, there is a minor degree of intrusion, but if the person does not give the consent, the call can be terminated immediately, and that's the end of the intrusion. And that's why we would like you to focus on the difference in technologies. There have been some Supreme Court cases decided recently in the First Amendment area that emphasize this point. I'd point the court to Ashcroft v. The American Civil Liberties Union and 524 U.S., which deals with online pornography and efforts by Congress to protect children from online pornography. And the holding of the court there is you cannot simply prohibit speakers from posting certain material on the Internet because there are blocking and filtering technologies that have emerged in the last few years that allow a much more focused selection between those people who do not want to receive the message and those people who do want to receive the message. And we think that that's consistent with this court's position in the National Coalition of Prayer case that you decided last year, which makes the point that a statute that cannot differentiate between the persons who want to receive a message and those who don't want to receive a message is not narrowly tailored and is almost certainly unconstitutional. We think that the programming ability of the interactive voice recognition technology software allows you to do precisely that. It allows you to ask an immediate question and get an immediate response and then disconnect if people don't want to hear the message and to continue with the pre-recorded message if people do want to hear it. And what the record shows is that there is a large number of people in Indiana who do choose to participate in these surveys and opinion questionnaires that my client sends out. The record shows that of the roughly half the people pick up the phone when a call is made, and of that 50%, roughly 20% choose to answer the entire survey and go through to the end, and other people answer some of the calls before they hang up. That shows, I think, clearly that there is speech that Indiana residents are willing to receive that is cut off by the absolute flat prohibition that treats this technology as if it's dumb technology and requires a live operator in every case.
Can you get to the younger abstention issue? And I just want to ask first, what's the status of the state court suit?
The state court is ongoing, but has progressed very little, Your Honor. According to the docket sheet there, the complaint has been answered, or the state filed a revised complaint. A revised answer was submitted. And an initial wave of discovery, small wave of discovery, is underway. In our judgment, there's no way that that case could be tried much before sometime in 2008. So the case is alive but progressing slowly.
And so there are no steps that Free, in your view, Free Eats could take to try to get a quick ruling in the state court?
There are steps that could be taken down there, Your Honor, but I wanted to bring you back to the abstention issue. There is a long line of Supreme Court cases which stands for the proposition that jurisdiction of the federal courts almost always should be exercised if it's present. Younger is an exception to that standard, which applies in certain circumstances, but Younger itself is limited. And there's a line of cases beginning with Gibson v. Berryhill in 411 U.S. and going through the Pennzoil versus Texaco case, 481 U.S. 1, which state, in a circumstance where the federal plaintiff cannot raise and cannot obtain a timely resolution of constitutional challenges, then it is not appropriate for the district court to abstain. The court should exercise its jurisdiction and decide the case. And that's what happened here. Judge McKinney reviewed the record and from his 20 years of experience almost as an Indiana trial judge, understood that the combination of the recusal of the original trial judge in Indiana and the complicated state process for selecting a special judge to replace that judge was going to be time-consuming and would more than consume the time that was left before the November 2006 election. And given the exigent circumstances of First Amendment rights before an election that were in jeopardy of being snuffed out, and the limited amount of time remaining, and the impasse caused by the normal operation of the state procedure, the judge made a decision that in this specific case, the state forum did not provide an adequate means of having these issues heard before the election, and it was appropriate for the federal court to exercise its jurisdiction. I also want to draw Your Honor's attention to, again, to the Pennzoil v. Texaco case, 481 U.S. 1. If you look at Section 3 of that opinion, you'll see that the Supreme Court there explicitly states that on appellate review, the record before the court, the record on which the appellate court should make its decision, are the facts that were before the judge, the facts that happened at the time that the federal suit was filed, and that you don't take into account sort of after affected developments. And I don't think that it's, to follow on your honor's train of thought again, I don't think that there is an intrusion on state comity here. The district court judge applied the correct line that says that younger abstention is not appropriate when there's not a timely resolution possible in the state court. And he applied the law to the facts correctly and found that there was going to be an impasse, which did, in fact, result in a long delay in appointing the new judge. The new judge didn't step in until November 16th.
Well, Judge McKinney decided this case 6 months ago, and it's still unresolved in state court. So that would seem to be a vindication of Judge McKinney's view that time was of the essence here, and he had to get it decided before the November 06 election.
I agree, Your Honor, and this case is nowhere near moving. But what the Pennzoil case teaches us is that is the record that should be reviewed, what Judge Kenney had before him. And if one assumes that the Pennzoil exception applies and that Judge Kenney applied it appropriately, there is no offense to comity in an appellate court continuing to review Judge McKinney's decision on the merits in a situation where he was right to take jurisdiction and decide the merits in the first place.
Well, we'll hear from Mr. Fisher on that.
I'm confident you will, Your Honor. If I may, I'll turn back to the First Amendment argument here briefly. The undisputed facts in the record show that these were political calls made in interstate commerce. They also show that there are a large number of people in Indiana who were willing to receive this call, as indicated by their participation rate. And we also have shown that the cost implications of the live operator requirement are enormous. The Judge McKinney found erroneously, we submit, that the reason that the statute was constitutional is that people could not disconnect the phone once the phone call started. If you look at the transcripts of the speech here, you'll see that what is involved is this interactive technology. We use it every day. When you call 411, you give them the name of a person you wish to speak to, and the computer automatically searches for the name associated with it. You use this kind of technology when you call a bank and ask for your balance or how many credit card transactions you've had recently. It's in common use. And if you look at the scripts that are attached to the in our appendix, you'll see that the way the questions are asked basically follows a decision tree. The technology asks the person a question, and depending upon the answer, the technology goes to a different set of questions.
That's when that person initiates the call. Those are responsive things. For instance, if you call, like I do, Amtrak, you know, you have to say things, punch buttons to get the next thing. If you call a doctor's office, you have to do 1, 2, 3, 4. You call a pharmacy, you have to do the same thing on a prescription. But that's when I, the consumer, initiate the call. When you're getting incoming calls, that's where we are.
Correct, Your Honor. The incoming call will consist first of a question saying, do you wish to receive a pre-recorded call? The state could easily pass a statute that requires that. And under those circumstances, the individual would have a right to continue or to terminate the call, but the individual would make the individual's own determination whether to hear that speech or not. That is the teaching of cases like City of Ladue or Martin v. Struthers, that the government may not make a decision on behalf of all of its residents that a certain kind of speech, political speech especially, is offensive. The government is required to find a way to have a fit a tailoring by which the individuals may decide whether the individuals want to receive that information or not. It's left up to the individual initiative. And the Supreme Court cases allow people, speakers, political speakers, to approach individuals at their home and ask them the question whether they wish to hear a political message or not.
Political speech is accepted, isn't it, under the Indiana no-call list statute?
That's a no-call statute, as the court discussed that in National Coalition of Prayer, and it's handled differently there. But we're talking here about a blanket prohibition that applies to all pre-recorded calls to Indiana residents, whether they be through interactive technology or not, or whether they're political or not. The same rule applies to a call from Target asking you if you want to have their special as opposed to political calls. And that, it seems to us, is the critical point that's in error in the Indiana statute. It does not respect First Amendment rights, political speech, and give them the greater degree of protection to which they're entitled when there is an easily available mechanism that could be required to deal with new technology. To decide the case in our favor, you do not have to decide that all robocalls, as the amici call them, would automatically be constitutional. That's not necessary. Older calls where the cassette just is dumb technology and plays the speech from beginning to end is different from our technology, which can be programmed to ask a specific question. And as the scripts in the appendix show you, if the person is asked yes or no, the person does not respond, the technology prompts the person again. And if the person still does not respond, it says, you must respond. If not, this call is going to be terminated. So the record shows that there's ample power within this technology to terminate a call if an individual does not give consent. And as I say, Ashcroft is a case that shows that you need to take these technologies into account, the evolution. The same result comes in Playboy Entertainment versus FCC, where the technology there was cable TV, and the Supreme Court said you simply cannot prevent a certain kind of speaker from putting protected speech on the cable network when there are blockering and filtering devices available to keep that parents can use to keep their children from accessing that. And finally, we submit that the mistake that Judge McKinney made is the same mistake that the court made in Van Bergen, really the sole authority on which he relied. A 1995 Minnesota case that itself relied on the notion that these were robocalls, that when you began playing a call, the individual had no ability to cut that off or terminate it, other than by hanging up. But we're talking about a different way of terminating that, a way that the individual can say no. And if it's desired, the technology also can be programmed to ask the recipient if the recipient wishes to receive further calls from the speaker. That's what my client Free Eats does. It makes a lot of franking calls on behalf of members of Congress who have opinion surveys and questionnaires that they want to send out, and they get good response rates to those because people are very anxious to tell their elected representatives where they stand on issues. And in those calls, the client asks, do you wish to receive a pre-recorded call from your congressman on issues of current import? And then you ask, do you wish to receive further communications from the congressman? That can be done with the technology. What's wrong here is that the state has a blanket prohibition on all kinds of political speech, even though it can be delivered in a way that does not intrude on residential privacy any more than the live operator does. And even though the cost implications of this are so great. And those are the two problems that the court did not deal with in Van Bergen. The Eighth Circuit treated this as dumb technology, not smart technology, and so it had the same caricature of technology that was fundamentally askew. And the court there also did not look at the cost implications. It assumed that the cost of a live operator call and the cost of a pre-recorded call would be about the same. It was an assumption, and we have record evidence to show that that is simply wrong. Now, with the court's permission, I'll turn to the preemption issue. Our position here is that the state's ability to regulate political speech delivered by pre-recorded calls is preempted by the Communications Act of 1934 as amended by the Telecommunications Privacy Act.
So that issue
Act.
Was raised in North Dakota in that litigation, and you lost that.
It was raised in North Dakota, Your Honor. With respect, we believe the court there misunderstood the statutory scheme.
But why aren't you collaterally estopped from raising that issue again?
Well, the answer is this is a different statute from the North Dakota statute, Your Honor. And also, as we cite in our...
But you argued preemption.
We did argue a preemption argument, Your Honor, against the different statute. But as we cite in our reply brief, there are questions of law involved here, and parties are not stopped in raising questions of law, or we'd have a very different kind of jurisprudence. I'd cite you to the case of Woodley v. Maynard, the 430 U.S., the New Hampshire license plate on Live Free or Die. The man won his constitutional challenge there on the fourth time that he ran afoul of the state. So you don't have preemption on broad legal arguments like this. The Section 152A says that the FCC has jurisdiction over all interstate communications.
Excuse me, you know you're in your rebuttal time.
Yes, and I'm going to make this very short. Thank you, Your Honor. The governing case on that is U.S. v. Southwestern Cable, which says all interstate communications should be interpreted as all interstate communications. Section 152B allows the federal power here, the FCC, to intrude into some intrastate matters, and the TCPA constituted a further intrusion into state power than it previously had.
And in 1988, but not after 1991?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Indiana law?
1988, not 1991, and it hasn't been updated to reflect the TCPA.
But in Indiana, there was a law before the 1991 law.
Yes, and the Congress
was that overridden in 1991, do you think?
We think it was overridden in 1992 when the FCC issued an implementing rule that said political calls should be permissible and will not be subject to the prohibition on pre-recorded calls that otherwise would apply to them. And with that, Your Honor, I'll defer the rest of my time to rebuttal.
Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I would like to begin with abstention, and it's important to know that Free Eats had its chance for a day in court to have quick justice, equally as quick as what it received in the United States District Court. There was a preliminary injunction hearing set for October the 6th, 2 days after the preliminary injunction hearing in this case, and Free Eats filed a motion to continue that hearing and to put off the preliminary injunction hearing. That's in state court. And they did that by volunteering to the court that they were not going to be making any further calls, and that they were not making calls pending resolution in the federal court.
Who was going to hear that case?
I'm sorry?
What judge would have heard that?
That would have been Judge Van Winkle, the judge that qualified to take the case after Judge Stewart recused herself, and whose stewardship of the case was then pretermitted by the Economic Freedom Forum's motion for change of judge that was actually filed before Judge Van Winkle actually got the case. So there is a system in Indiana to ensure fair and impartial adjudication, but I don't think the state should be penalized by affording these kinds of opportunities. The rules say that the judge that has jurisdiction of the case has jurisdiction over emergency motions, including preliminary injunction hearings. Now, that likely would not have been the end of the road for the case, regardless of the outcome. No matter who the judge was, there would have been an opportunity for appeal, just like there's an opportunity for appeal here. But it's disingenuous for Free Eats to say that it did not have a chance for a day in court. It had a preliminary injunction hearing scheduled that it put off.
I just think that's odd to be arguing as vigorously as you are arguing for abstention here when you got a decision on the merits, which I think you obviously like.
I like it very much, and the reason that I argue vigorously about younger abstention is that states have an institutional concern about preserving the ability of their courts to weigh in.
Well, but there are 13 states that filed an amicus brief here, and none of them have argued for abstention. They want this decision on the merits to stand.
I think they didn't want to repeat arguments that we were already making, in part. And
well, they didn't say that.
Well, but
it looks like they're happy with this decision on the merits that Judge McKinley has made.
They're not here. We can't ask them, I suppose. The national issue of First Amendment ability to regulate in this area is, of course, of great concern. But of equally great concern is the state's ability to enforce its laws in state courts. The Attorney General could not have brought its state enforcement action in federal court as a response to this lawsuit. There's just no jurisdiction for the federal court to do that. We have to go to state court to enforce our law, and we have the right to do that. And Younger says when there's an enforcement action where the constitutional issues can be raised in defense, that is entitled to deference and federal courts should abstain. As for the notion that there was some sort of an emergency that required fast action by a federal court as opposed to a state court, the motions panel of this court already said that there was not the sort of emergency circumstance at stake that would justify expedited appellate consideration. And
but
I don't.
If Judge McKinley would have gone the other way here, it would have been 8, 10, 12 days before the election, and these calls then could have been made to have some effect on the November 06 election. And so there was a time issue here that and I'm just having a hard time seeing how Judge McKinley blew it here by proceeding to the merits and giving a decision.
Let's start with the status quo as of when Judge McKinney was considering the case. There was no injunction against Free Eats from making the call. In the state court system, we were seeking an injunction against Free Eats to keep them from making the calls. But so long as there was no hearing, which Free Eats assured that there was not, there was no injunction. Free Eats stepped forward and voluntarily ceased making calls pending what the federal court would do. Now, if the federal court were to have ruled in favor of Free Eats on the preliminary injunction, let's think about what that would have meant. There would have been an injunction as requested by Free Eats against the state from proceeding with its state enforcement action. That says nothing about giving immunity to Free Eats to make its calls. Free Eats would have been in no different position. Who knows what would have happened down the road if that had been reversed.
In that situation, I would have expected you to vigorously argue Younger abstention applies, but on the basis of this record, I don't see why Indiana is pushing that argument.
There was nothing keeping Free Eats, nothing of an injunctive nature, keeping Free Eats from making its calls regardless. Indiana wanted that injunction in state court. Nobody ever had a day on that because Free Eats voluntarily ceased making calls. They chose to do that themselves. If the Indiana court had held a preliminary injunction hearing and had ruled in Free Eats' way, that probably would have given Free Eats even more comfort than they could have gotten from a federal injunction, because then they would have had the very court considering the enforcement action against them, telling them that they could go make the calls that they wanted to make, as opposed to a federal court who was trying to preserve the status quo pending federal resolution of some more limited constitutional issues. So, in fact, their remedy in state court was probably much more promising than anything they could have gotten from a federal district judge.
Let me ask you this. If the election were still pending today, would you still argue that abstention is appropriate?
Yes, precisely because we would still be in the position where the relief that we wanted immediately, which was preliminary injunctive relief, would have been something that would have given Free Eats its immediate day in court, in state court. Now, let's suppose that there was an election coming up.
There is.
On the horizon. There is, absolutely. And let's suppose Free Eats says, we've got a bunch of clients that really want us to make some calls, so we're now going to withdraw our promise not to make any calls in Indiana. What would be the state's reaction? We would probably at that point file a new motion for preliminary injunction in the state court proceeding to get an adjudication in joining them from making calls. Let's suppose we are successful in doing that. There would be a right to immediate appeal to the Indiana Court of Appeals and up to the Indiana Supreme Court. No more cumbersome a process than anything that would parallel in the federal courts. Now, it just so happens that Free Eats pretermitted that process in Indiana while it permitted and pushed the federal process to go forward. So here we are on appeal much earlier by virtue of Free Eats' own conduct, their own litigation conduct in state court. I'll turn now to the First Amendment issues, unless there are further questions about abstention.
Preemption. You only touched on it. That's a big issue with me, at least.
Yeah. It's important to go back to the 1934 Act to begin with. I think that an important concession here is that there would have been no preemption before the 1992 implementation of the 1991 TCPA, because there's nothing in the TCPA that expressly preempts states from doing anything. The whole argument surrounding preemption that Free Eats relies on actually requires the court to read the original 1934 Act as precluding states from regulating interstate telephone calls that harass or defraud or do any of those kinds of things. The 1934 Act instead speaks solely in terms of regulating the transmission of telecommunications, meaning the services and facilities. It's all about regulating the telephone companies and the laying of the wires and the rates and all of those things. It's not about preventing people from defrauding others in other states with interstate telephone calls or harassing them. We've had a law against obscene telephone calls, and of course we can enforce that against obscene telephone calls that come across state lines. And that was true before 1991, and it's true after 1991. The TCPA itself includes nothing that preempts states in this regard. And in fact, the federal regime ensures that there is not a uniform national policy with respect to telemarketing. They've divided up federal regulation of telemarketing between the FCC and the FTC. There are two different federal bodies even that regulate this, so it's hard to say that there is a uniform policy that somehow the state of Indiana is disrupting. Once you read the original Federal Communications Act and you find those definitions that say that that there is a regulation there of the facilities and the services of interstate telecommunications, that does not have anything to say about harassing telephone calls, auto dialers, do not call lists, anything of the sort. That has been something that even the South Dakota or North Dakota Supreme Court ruled, and we submit that there is therefore collateral estoppel on this issue. The idea that somehow just because this is a constitutional issue that the collateral estoppel shouldn't apply, I think, is too broad an idea. I think that idea has some merit, particularly where there are litigants who are unique, who don't have the ability to rely on others to come forward and challenge similar regulations in other courts. But Free Eats is a telemarketer. There are lots of telemarketers. It's not like they're a unique institutional litigant that can't depend on the idea that's just statistically speaking, someone else is going to challenge these laws someday. That is something that is very likely to happen, whether it's in Indiana or somewhere else. There is one more point I wanted to make about the Federal Communications Act and how we know that it does not speak to these kinds of laws. It does specifically exempt and have a carve-out for state regulation of intrastate telecommunications. But that is further qualified by the notion that such state intrastate regulation must be undertaken by a particular type of state commission. In Indiana, it would be the IURC or something like that, a regulatory commission, not the Attorney General. Well, Free Eats is not arguing that the Indiana Attorney General is preempted from enforcing this law against intrastate calls. They're quite clear that they think that is permissible under the Telecommunications Act. But if we are to take the argument literally, that there is preemption by virtue of federal regulation of interstate telecommunications, then the intrastate application would be preempted as well, because here the regulation is by the Attorney General, not by a state commission. And if you read, again, the sections of the Federal Communications Act, when they refer to these state commissions, they're plainly referring to commissions that are going to govern things like price structures and tariffs and that sort of thing.
Let me ask you, how do you respond to Freed's argument that you can't raise your collateral estoppel argument for the first time here on appeal?
We really never had a chance below. Here's the way it played out. When Free Eats filed its motion for preliminary injunction, they didn't file a brief right away. They filed their brief the day before the preliminary injunction hearing, where they sat out all of their arguments, including their preemption argument. And then the hearing was the next day. Well, we didn't have time to write a brief between that day and the next day. Well, at the preliminary injunction hearing, we were quite clear with Judge McKinney that we were interested in filing a response to their preliminary injunction brief. And as the hearing progressed, it became clear, I think, to Judge McKinney that he wanted to focus, in terms of our response, only on their Commerce Clause argument, which they've now jettisoned. So at the end of the hearing, he told us to file a brief limited only to the Commerce Clause arguments, and that's what we did. So there was never an opportunity to respond in writing on preemption and in a way that would have allowed us to bring up collateral estoppel. Now, at the hearing itself, I did talk about collateral estoppel, and my point to Judge McKinney was, here's a reason why an argument of Freed's does not work with respect to preemption. They are collaterally estopped. You can't use any kind of idea that there's a slam-dunk preemption argument here to thwart Younger abstention because they are collaterally estopped. And then I said, we don't want you to reach the collateral estoppel issue in the context of, please rule our way on Younger abstention. It wasn't that we were somehow waiving collateral estoppel. It was that we were trying to make the point that Younger abstention would not require him to get to that issue. So we did talk about it with the judge, and we just never really had the opportunity, the way the case played out, to put it down in writing in the terms that we would have liked. But I don't think that suggests we've waived it. And let's think furthermore about what would happen if this is a case at the preliminary injunction stage, and if it goes back down for some kind of merits review, if Free Eats is successful, well, then we're going to be in an opportunity there to raise collateral estoppel. We're not barred from raising it at that point, so I don't see much sort of judicial economy in somehow ruling that we've waived it at this point either. I'll turn now to the First Amendment points, unless the court has
a question. Then.
Sure, yeah.
You got the 88 law, mm-hmm. and then in 92, there are things that are pending. For instance, this the savings clause issue. There's argument that it's poorly drafted, et cetera. It seems to me it says, once you translate it, it says certain things that this is not preempted. There's also something pending, and I'm not clear what it is. It's in page 21 of the blue brief. Free Eats is one of several parties that has petitioned for a declaratory ruling with FCC, not yet made a decision. Now, I assume it's with regard to this issue here. And there's still nothing happened, I presume.
That's right. The FCC has had multiple petitions on this and other telemarketing issues, essentially asking for federal preemption of state telecommunications laws as applied to interstate calls. They've had those for more than 2 years. Who knows when that's going to be resolved, but it is still pending there.
But we have to decide this notwithstanding, I presume.
I think so, yeah. There's no reason not to. I mean, we don't want you to decide it because we want Younger abstention, but to the extent that the court feels it has to reach the merits, then yes, there's nothing, I think, about FCC proceeding.
It's a decision that it is or is not preempted.
Right.
And I assume that's what they're looking at. I don't know for sure.
It is squarely in front of them, but I don't think that that's a reason for this court to not to reach the issue if it thinks that the merits are something it needs to reach. But I think that savings clause is very important in that it as understood and applied in North Dakota and in the Van Bergen case, it's understood to say shall preempt any state law which prohibits, among other things, the use of automatic dialers and the use of pre-recorded messages. It's a fairly straightforward reading of the statute that we're urging to say that there is going to be no preemption. Now, we don't know what the FCC is going to do with this, but it's important to understand that when they issued their rulemaking on their own federal do not call list, they acknowledged that our reading of the statute is reasonable. They acknowledged an ambiguity about it. So it's not as if there's nothing supporting what we've been urging, and other courts have agreed with us as far as that goes. But even apart from the savings clause, there's nothing in the TCPA that says that states are preempted. And in fact, there is a later section of the TCPA after the savings clause. I think it's 227F6 or something like that, where it says that states are not precluded from enforcing their general civil and criminal laws as a result of the TCPA. Well, if that's the case, then it doesn't make much sense to say, well, that because this somehow references auto dialers, that it can't be enforced, as opposed to if it were cast in broader terms. That would become a form over substance kind of issue. If the state could regulate the same thing by casting it in more general terms, then we ought to be able to regulate it as written as well. And again, there's nothing else in the TCPA that says that there is any notion of preemption at all. Moving to the First Amendment then.
All right, and before you
sure.
present your argument, I just have a question. Isn't there a legitimate First Amendment concern here with cutting off an entire mode of communicating political messages, particularly in light of the recent technologies and the development in technologies that counsel points out?
Your Honor, regulation imposes costs, and that was as true in National Coalition as it is here. The charities that were challenging the law in National Coalition were challenging it because the costs imposed by the regulation prevented them from making the kinds of calls they wanted to. This is no more a cutting off of an entire mode of speech than the do not call list is with respect to charities who can't afford to have their own, that can only afford to hire outside telemarketers and not have their own employees or volunteers make their calls. That's the nature of regulation. In Kovacs v. Cooper, the Supreme Court was clear that the idea of prohibiting sound trucks was okay, even though it would probably mean that some speakers wouldn't be able to get their message out effectively. That's just the nature of regulation, and it doesn't matter if there's a precise number attached to it or not. The costs are always going to go up, and that is always going to mean that some group of speakers isn't going to be able to afford to speak the way it would like. But that's not a rationale for enjoining states from implementing content-neutral time, place, and manner regulations. I think that the central difference between this case and National Coalition, as far as the Do Not Call law goes, is just essentially the shift of the burden. There you had consumers signing up to be on a list, and here there is a presumption against calling all consumers. But I think it's important to step back and take a look at the regulation system as a whole. This law came first, auto dialers did, to be sure, in 1988. And it says no auto dialers using pre-recorded messages, period, with a couple of exceptions. Then later, the Do Not Call law came along and said, even if you're not going to use an auto dialer, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm trying to give a systematic read of this, even if you're not using an auto dialer, you can't call people who have registered and don't want to receive telephone calls as long as you're selling products or services or soliciting charitable contributions. It does not define the scope of coverage to include political calls. Here, the scope of coverage, there's no real definition given to it. It's just no one can use auto dialers and pre-recorded messages. But that means that political calls are covered. But with respect to Do Not Call, the definitions given there do not cover political calls, which means that political calls are not regulated as much as commercial calls or charitable solicitations. They are treated with greater deference. They've got an overall less regulatory burden than those other kinds of calls. So the reason, though, that there is permissible to have the burden against calling as opposed to putting the burden on the consumer to sign up for a list is precisely because of the volume. We're not here because we're worried about disconnections and that sort of thing. The main concern of the state of Indiana with respect to auto dialers is privacy. Now, privacy gets disrupted in many ways, but one of the main ways is when telemarketers make a lot of calls in a very short period of time and they bother people repeatedly. The idea that Freeze can make 1.7 million telephone calls in 7 hours is astonishing. It is a lot of calls. And then they say that if there is no answer, they will call the same number up to 3 times. It doesn't take much to disrupt residential privacy, especially in Indiana, where we've got a very strong no-call law, and people are very used to the idea of preserving their privacy. So the idea that there can be these repeat calls that disrupt privacy the moment the telephone rings is an important regulatory interest. It's a compelling interest for the state. And therefore, when we're talking about something of this power in terms of calling lots of numbers in a very short period of time, the state has leeway, I think, not to require people to sign up, but instead to say that we're just going to prohibit these unless consent is given in advance, which is an important distinction, I think, from other First Amendment cases. There is the ability of consumers and citizens to say, it's okay, you can call me, and that can be done either by a live operator before the call, or you could imagine a situation where Free Eats might send out postcards to people to say, we would like you to consent to receiving our calls, and they could send them back. I mean, and then they'd be set to go no matter the time frame before the election. Now, I suspect not a lot of people would respond to that and would say, yes, you please call me within 2 weeks of an election. But that just reflects that people don't really want to receive these calls. There's an overwhelming percentage of the people that Free Eats calls that don't want to hear the message. They hang up and terminate the call before even hearing one question, and even if they hear one or two, they don't stay on for the whole survey.
These, just as a practical matter, are these calls generally last-minute get-out-the-vote? Are they issue calls? Where they, I'm talking about the political ones, where they talk about a certain candidate, either these days usually trashing them, but some kind of a political message. And we've all gotten certain calls. I don't think I personally have ever gotten one. I've gotten the ones where they call up and say, do you want to hear a message from somebody? But I've never really gotten one of these.
Well, I can't speak for all that Freed's does. If you look at the Freed's appendix at A39, they've got a transcript of something they did on September 12, 2006. And the first question out of the box is not, by the way, do you want to receive this call or would you like to terminate? It is instead, are you registered to vote? Or this is a survey with a 45-second public survey. Are you registered to vote in Indiana? And then it goes on from there and eventually gets down to, do you want your taxes not raised and, if possible, cut? And there are other questions about taxes. There's a mention of a candidate for Congress and his position. And so I think it links issues with candidates and probably is an overall attempt to get a picture of things right before the election.
It could be a variety of things. I know it was maybe in the amicus or something where they talk about middle-of-the-night calls, pretending you're the other guy. I don't know whether there's any of that kind of abuse or
well,
not.
Well, I think, but I think just the idea that it's out there tells you something. It tells you that people hate these calls so much that one political campaign is willing to pull a dirty trick on another political campaign by putting the label on them for making the calls in the first place. Not because they're not making the calls to get a message out. They're making the calls to say the other guy's dirty and rotten for calling you.
Sort of a push-pull is another one they call.
Yes, sometimes you get those as well. But it's all just a reflection that this is an issue of extraordinary importance to citizens, and it goes to the privacy in their homes, and it's not an unreasonable regulation. It's not insufficiently narrowly tailored to say that citizens ought not to receive these calls unless they've stepped forward in advance to say, yes, we don't mind being called with an auto dialer and a pre-recorded message. As opposed to signing up beforehand on a no-call list. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Mr. Cooney? You got about 4 minutes?
Very good. Your Honor, the application... I'm sorry, did I interrupt?
I couldn't see how my fingers yelled up.
The First Amendment's application does not depend upon the script that Freed followed in this call. That script was drafted to comply with federal law and did comply with federal law. The question on the First Amendment is whether Indiana could pass a statute that would appropriately recognize the consent obtaining ability of these interactive calls. So the pointing out to what's in our call is not relevant on the First Amendment point, but it does show the preemption problem we have here because we are complying with the FCC requirements and the state is adding a second layer of requirements on top of those, including a blanket prohibition.
What about the savings clause? I know that maybe...
Right.
Not important to everybody, but at least it seems that does decide whether or not, or helps decide whether or not it's preempted.
Oh, let me approach it this way, Your Honor. The state has tried to set up its argument on the saving clause by saying it had authority to regulate calls from the beginning. Our position is that the calls were explicitly preempted by the FCC in 1992 in its rule, but before that, the state faced the burden of the Dormant Commerce Clause. The FCC had authority to regulate all interstate communications, and the ability of a state to regulate interstate calls would have run directly into the Dormant Commerce Clause. Congress, in passing the TCPA, explicitly found that the states did not have authority to regulate interstate calls. That's the answer to Your Honor's question about the statute being passed in 1988. It was part of that class of statute that Congress found in Section 2.7 of the TCPA didn't provide enough protection against interstate operations of pre-recorded calls. That's why the TCPA was necessary. But the state has made a big point that it has the authority to regulate calls, and it does that by setting up miscitingthe statute. It cites Section 151 of the statute, which talks about facilities and services. And so the state always focuses on 152, and they never mention that the applicable statute is 152, which gives interstate communications to the FCC. Now, why this is important is the savings clause. What the state is trying to work its way around are the canons of construction established by U.S. v. Locke, which say, first, there is no presumption against preemption in an area where the federal government has regulated extensively, as it has in wire and radio communications, including telephone. The second point of Locke is a court should not read a savings clause to upend the regulatory statute and the allocation of jurisdiction that Congress has provided for many years. But that's exactly what the state is asking you to do here. They're asking you to read ambiguous language in the savings clause and find that at the end it has the effect of giving the states authority to prohibit interstate telephone calls when they've never had that authority before, and it's counterintuitive to think they have that authority in a statute that was providing the federal government with the ability to intrude in the areas that previously had been fenced off from it and given to the states. Now the federal government exercises that authority. My reaction on the savings clause is the reaction of Justice Scalia in the AT&T versus Iowa State Utilities Board, looking at provisions of the 1996 Communications Act, which let the federal government intrude in the previous state power over local competition. And the justice's point there is that it would be surpassingly strange to have a statute that announces a new federal policy and then has the new federal policy and program depend upon the different laws of the 50 states. But that's precisely what the state is arguing for. So our position on the saving clause is that the language is ambiguous, not capable of any sure interpretation, and therefore the court should look to the secondary factors that help in interpretation, such as Locke, such as Justice Scalia's statement in the AT&T case, and on that basis it should conclude that the there's no basis for finding preemption and state I'm sorry, there's no basis for finding state authority over calls that have been committed to the federal government since 1934 under Section 152A of the Communications Act.
Okay. Thanks very much to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.